Won't you give me what I need? Scorching the air in my lungs, flash frying my brain, and charring my backbone. I collapse to the floor, human ashes. As suddenly and unexpectedly as the sexual inferno had raised every cell in my body, it was gone, leaving me cold and, for brief moments, in agonizing pain, ravenous for delights that could only be sampled by eating from a banquet table at which humans were never meant to sit. Forbidden fruit. Poisonous fruit. Fruit a woman might sell her soul for. Perhaps even betray mankind.
Careful, Shisir. I have chosen to spare you. Do not press your luck.
I locked my jaw, pushed myself up, and lit another match, studying my enemies in the flickering light. Both would devour me, just in different ways. If forced to choose, I'd take death by shade. Why have you chosen to spare me?
I want us to be, what is your word? Friends.
Psychotic rapists don't have friends.
I was unaware you were a psychotic rapist, or I would not have offered.
Ha! I'd set myself up for that one. He smiled, and I recognized the urge I suddenly felt to believe everything was wonderful with my world for the illusion it was. Royal Fae pack a psychic punch. Baron says their entire being is designed to seduce on every level. Glamour piled upon illusion, heaped upon deceit. You can't believe a word they say.
I am unaccustomed to interacting with humans, and have been known to underestimate my impact upon them. I did not understand how deeply the Shiva High would disturb you. I wish to start again,
he said. I dropped my match and lit another. Start by getting rid of the shade.
With the cuff, you would be able to saunter among them freely without fear. You would never be so vulnerable again. Why would you refuse such power?
Ah, gee, let's see. Maybe because I trust you less than I trust the shades? At least the shade was too stupid to be deceptive, I think.
What is trust, Shisir, but expectation that another will behave in a certain fashion consistent with prior actions?
Great definition. Examine your prior actions.
I did. It is you who do not see me clearly. I came to you offering a gift to protect your life. You are a beautiful woman who dresses to command male attention. I gave it to you. I did not know the Shiva High would distress you as it did. I even offered to pleasure you without price. You refused me. Perhaps I was offended. You menace me with a weapon stolen from my race. You speak to me of reasons not to trust when you have given me a multitude. You are a suspicious, larcenous being with homicidal tendencies. Despite your continued threats to do vile things to me, I remain here, withholding what offends you, offering aid.
I was getting low on matches. How cleverly he'd turned things around, as if he'd done nothing wrong, and I was the dangerous one. Oh, drop the act, Tinkerbell, and get rid of my problem. Then we'll talk.
Will we talk?
I frowned and lit another match. There was a catch here somewhere, but I wasn't sure what it was. I said we would.
As friends, we'll talk.
Friends do not have sex, if that's what you're getting at. That wasn't true, but he didn't necessarily know that. I'm heir to the sex-is-just-sex generation, and I hate it. Not only friends have sex, people who don't like each other have sex. I had once caught Natalie and Rick, two people I know for a fact can't stand each other, banging away in the bathroom at the brickyard. When later I'd asked her what had changed, she'd said nothing. She still couldn't stand him. But he'd sure looked hot tonight. Doesn't anybody get that sex is what you make it? And if you treat it like nothing, it is. I don't clean the restrooms anymore. I leave that to Val. She's lower on the seniority totem pole. For the past few years, I'd been on a quest for a good old-fashioned date, the kind where the guy calls, makes the plans, picks you up in a car that's not his dad's or his other girlfriend's, and takes you somewhere that shows he put thought into what you might like. Not what he might get off on, like the latest how many naked boobs can we cram into this movie to disguise the complete lack of plot movie. I'm looking for the kind of date that starts with good conversation, has a sweet and satisfying middle, and ends with long, slow kisses and the dreamy feeling that you're walking on clouds.
That is not what I was implying. We will sit, the two of us, and talk of more than threats and fears and the differences between us. We will spend one of your hours as friends.
I didn't like the careful way he'd phrased that. One of my hours?
Our hours are much longer, Shisir. See how freely I converse with you, telling you of our ways? So trust begins.
Something about the shade drew my attention. It took me a minute to figure out what it was. Its demeanor had changed. It was still predatory, but it was angry now. I could sense it the same way I'd felt its mockery earlier. I could also sense that its anger was not directed at me. I lit another match and contemplated it. I had four matches left and an uneasy suspicion that Vlaine might be doing something to rein in the amorphous life-sucker. Was it possible this unnaturally strong shade could take me, even in the light, if Vlaine weren't here right now? Had he been holding it at bay since the beginning? 1 hour, I ground out. But I'm not taking the cuff. And you won't do that sexing me up thing. And I need coffee before we begin.
Not now. At a time of my choosing, Michaela.
He was calling me by name like we were friends. I didn't like it one bit. I lit my third, last match. Fine. Fix my problem. I was wondering just what I'd agreed to, and how many more demands Vlaine would make before getting rid of the shade. I had no doubt he'd draw it out until the last moment to scare and humiliate me as much as possible. When he mocked silkily,
"Let there be light,"
and suddenly all the lights in the room popped on. The shade exploded, shattering into countless dark pieces. They scrabbled toward the night, frantic cockroaches fleeing a bombed room, and I could sense the Unseelie was in unspeakable pain. If light didn't kill them, it was certainly their version of hell. After the last quivering fragment scuttled over the sill, I hurried to shut the window. The alley was once again brightly lit and empty. Vlaine was gone. I collected my flashlights, tucked them back into my waistband, and walked through the store, hunting for shades lurking in corners or hiding in closets. I found none. All the lights were back on, inside and out. It disturbed me deeply. As effortlessly as Vlaine had helped me, he could dump me back into the dark if he felt like it, without ever even having to enter the store. What else could he do? How powerful was a royal fae? Shouldn't the wards keep him from being able to influence physical matter beyond them? Speaking of wards, why hadn't they kept out the shades? Had barons only warded the property against the Lord Master? If he could perform such tricks, why not ward the entire building against everything? Except, of course, store patrons, although it was obvious the bookstore was just a cover. Barons needed more money, like Ireland needed more rain. I needed answers. I was sick of not getting any. I was surrounded by egotistical, unpredictable, moody, pushy jackasses, and my feeling was if you can't beat them, join them. I was confident I, too, could be a pushy jackass. I just needed a little practice. I wanted to know more about Barons. I wanted to know if he lived in this building or not. I wanted to know more about his mysterious garage. He'd slipped up not long ago and mentioned something about a vault 3 floors beneath it. I wanted to know what a man like him stored in an underground vault. I began with the store. The front half was just what it seemed, an eclectic and well-stocked bookstore. I dismissed it and moved to the rear half. The first floor was as impersonal as a museum, liberally and exorbitantly fitted with antiquities and artwork, but nothing that betrayed any real glimpse into the mind of the man who'd acquired the many artifacts. Even his study, the one room I expected to offer some personal portrayal of the man, presented only the cool, impersonal reflection of a large wood-framed mirror that occupied the wall between cherry bookcases. Behind the ornate 15th-century desk, there was no bedroom, kitchen, or dining room on the first floor. Every door on the second and third floors was locked. They were heavy, solid wood doors with complicated locks that I couldn't force or pick. I started out stealthily jiggling the doorknobs because I was afraid Barons might be in one of the rooms, but by the time I got to the third floor, I was giving them good hard shakes and pissed-off kicks. I'd awakened tonight to find myself in the dark. I was tired of being in the dark. I was tired of everyone else having control of the lights. I stomped back downstairs and outside to the garage. The rain had abated, but the sky was still dark with thunderclouds, and dawn was a promise I wouldn't have believed if I'd not lived through 22 years of them. Down the alley to my left, shades restlessly shaped and reshaped the darkness at the edge of the abandoned neighborhood. I flipped them off with both hands. I tested the garage door. Locked, of course. I went to the nearest blacked-out window and smashed it in with the butt of my flashlight. The tinkle of breaking glass soothed my soul. No alarm went off. Take that, Barons. Guess your world isn't so perfectly controlled after all. Perhaps it was warded, like the bookstore, against other threats, not me. I broke out the jagged edges so I wouldn't get cut, hoisted myself over the sill, and dropped to the floor. I flipped on the light switches by the door, then just stood there a minute, grinning like an idiot. I've seen his collection before, even ridden in a few of the cars, but the sight of them all together, one gleaming fantasy after another, is a total rush to somebody like me. I love cars. From sleek and sporty to squat and muscly, from luxury sedan to high-performance coupe, from state-of-the-art to timeless classic, I am a car fanatic, and Barons has them all. Well, maybe not all. I haven't seen him driving a Bugatti yet, and really, with 1,003 horsepower and a $1 million price tag, I'm hardly expecting to. But he's got pretty much every car of my dreams, right down to a 64-and-a-half Stingray, painted what else but British racing green. There, a black Maserati crouched next to a Wolf Countach. Here, a red Ferrari stretched on the verge of a purr, next to a... My smile died instantly. Rocky O'Banion's Maybach, reminding me of 16 deaths that shouldn't have happened to men who hadn't deserved to die, and at least part of it was on my head. 16 deaths I'd celebrated because they'd bought me a temporary stay of execution. Where do you put such conflicting feelings? Is this where I'm supposed to grow up and start compartmentalizing? Is compartmentalizing just another way of divvying up our sins, apportioning a few here and a few over there, shoving our internal furniture around to hide some, so we can go on living with the weight of them individually, because collectively they drown us? I shoved all thought of cars from my mind and began looking for doors. The garage had once been some kind of commercial warehouse, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it occupied nearly a city block. The floors were polished concrete, the walls poured concrete, the beams and girders steel. All the windows were painted black, from the glass block apertures near the ceiling to the 2 double-paned glass openings at ground level by the doors, one of which I had busted. The garage had a single retractable dock door. Other than that and a bunch of cars, there was nothing. No stairs, no closets, no trap doors hidden beneath rubber mats on the floor. I know, I looked. There was nothing. So where were the 3 subterranean levels, and how was I supposed to get down to them? I stood in the center of the enormous garage, surrounded by one of the finest car collections in the world, tucked away in a nondescript alley in Dublin, and tried to think like its bizarre owner. It was an exercise in futility. I wasn't sure he had a brain. Perhaps there was only a coldly efficient microchip in there. I felt, more than heard the noise, a rumble in my feet. I cocked my head, listening. After a moment, I got down on my hands and knees, brushed a thin veneer of dust from the floor, and pressed my ear to the cold concrete. Far beneath me, in the marrow of the ground, something bayed. It sounded maddened, bestial, and it raised the fine hair all over my body. I closed my eyes and tried to picture the mouth capable of making such a sound. It bayed over and over, each soul-chilling howl lasting a full minute or more, echoing up from its concrete tomb. What was down there? What kind of creature possessed such lung capacity? Why was it making such a sound? It was darker than a wail of despair, emptier than a funeral dirge. It was the bleak, tortured baying of a thing beyond salvation, abandoned, lost, condemned to the agony of hell without beginning or end. Chicken flesh sprouted all over my arms. There was a new cry then, this one more terrified than tortured. It rose in gruesome concert with that long, terrible howl. They both stopped. There was silence. I rapped my knuckles on the floor in frustration, wondering just how far in over my head I was. No longer feeling quite so jackassy or pushy, I left to go back to my room. As I stepped into the alley, the wind scooted trash along the pavement, and the dense cloud cover drifted apart to reveal a window of dark sky. Dawn was moments away, yet the moon was still bright and full. To my right, in the dark zone, shades no longer crouched in the shadows. They had fled something, and it wasn't the moon or the dawn. I'd watched them a lot from my window lately. They seeded the night in petulant degrees, the largest of them lingering until the last. I glanced to my left and sucked in a breath. "No," I whispered. Just beyond reach of the building floodlights, a tall, black-shrouded figure stood, folds of midnight cloth rustling in the wind. Several times over the past week, I'd thought I had glimpsed something out a window, late at night, something so trite and cliched that I'd refused to believe it was real. And I wouldn't now. Fay were bad enough. "You're not there," I told it. I dashed across the alley, vaulted up the stairs, kicked open the door, and burst through it. When I looked back, the specter was gone. I laughed shakily. I knew better. It had never been there to begin with. I took a shower, dried my hair, got dressed, grabbed a chilled latte from the fridge, and made it downstairs just in time for Fiona to show up and the police to arrive to arrest me. 4. I told you, he was working on my sister's case.
And when did you see him last?
I told you that, too. Yesterday morning, he stopped by the bookstore.
Why did he stop by the bookstore?
Oh, for heaven's sake, I told you that, too. To tell me he'd reviewed her case and there was still no new evidence and that he was sorry, but it was going to have to stay closed.
Do you expect me to believe Inspector O'Duffy, who incidentally has a lovely wife and 3 children he takes to church every Sunday, followed by brunch with his in-laws, a family outing he's missed only 4 times in the past 15 years, and then for funerals, bypassed that in favor of making an early morning personal visit to the sister of a deceased murder victim to tell her an already closed case was staying closed?
Well, fudge buckets. Even I was gripped by the illogic in that.
Why didn't he use the phone?
I shrugged. My interrogator, Inspector Jane, waved the 2 officers flanking the door from the room. He pushed up from the table and circled it, stopping behind me. I could feel him back there, staring down at me. I was acutely aware of the ancient stolen spear tucked into my boot, inside the leg of my jeans. If they charged and searched me, I was in big trouble.
You're an attractive young woman, Miss Lane.
Point.
Was there something going on between you and Inspector O'Duffy?
Oh, please. Do you really think he's my type?
Was, Miss Lane. Do I think he was your type? He's dead.
I glared up at the garda looming over me, trying to use dominant body posture to intimidate me. He didn't know how bad my day had already been, or that there wasn't much in the human world that frightened me anymore. Are you going to arrest me or not?
His wife said he's been distracted lately. Worried. Not eating. She had no idea why. You know?
No, I told you that too.
half a dozen times now. How many more times do we have to go over this? I sounded like a bad actor in a worse movie. He did, too.
As many times as I say we have to.
Let's take it from the beginning. Tell me again about the first time you saw him here at the station. I took a deep breath and closed my eyes.
Open your eyes and answer the question.
I opened my eyes and stared daggers up at him. I still couldn't believe O'Duffy was dead. Royally screwing up my world, he'd had his throat cut holding a scrap of paper with my name and the address of the bookstore written on it. It hadn't taken long for his brothers in, well, not exactly arms, the Dublin police don't carry guns, to come looking for me. I'd spent the morning battling shades, and a death-by-sex fae discovered something monstrous lived beneath Barron's garage right behind my bedroom, and now I was in the police station being interrogated on suspicion of murder. Could my day get any worse? Oh, they'd not pressed formal charges, but they'd sure used scare tactics on me back at the bookstore, making them think they were. And they'd made it clear they'd jump on any reason they could find to back me up against a wall and start snapping mugshots. I was a stranger in this city. Nearly all the answers I gave sounded evasive because they were evasive, and O'Duffy's Sunday morning visit to me really did look suspicious. I repeated the story I'd told an hour ago, and an hour before that, and an hour before that. He asked the same questions he and two men before him had asked, all morning and a good part of the afternoon. They'd let me stew for 45 minutes while they went to lunch and came back smelling scrumptiously of vinegary fish and chips, phrased in minutely different ways, all designed to trip me up. The caffeine from my chilled latte had worn off hours ago, and I was starving. On one level, I could appreciate what Inspector Jane was doing. It was his job. He was doing it very well, and it was obvious Patrick O'Duffy had been his friend. I hoped they'd done the same for Alina. On another level, it infuriated me. My problems were so much bigger than this. It was an epic waste of my time. Not only that, I felt exposed. With the exception of my trip across the back alley this morning, I hadn't set foot outside of the bookstore since I'd seen what I'd seen in the warehouse at 1247 LaRue a week ago. I felt like a walking target with a bullseye painted on my forehead. Did the Lord Master know where to find me? How high was I on his list of priorities? Was he still wherever he'd gone when he'd stepped through that portal? Was he watching the bookstore? Did he have his rhino boys, those watchdogs of the Fae, the lower caste of enormous, ugly, gray-skinned unseelie with wide, squat, barrel bodies, jutting underbites and bumpy foreheads, waiting to grab me the moment I walked out of the police station by myself? Should I try to get myself formally arrested? I discarded that thought the instant I had it. Humans couldn't keep me alive. I blinked. Started to realize I no longer quite counted myself in that camp.
"He was my brother-in-law,"
he said abruptly. I winced.
"Assuming you had nothing to do with his murder, I still have to find a way to tell my sister what the fuck he was doing with you the morning he died,"
he said bitterly.
"So what the fuck was he doing, Miss Lane? Because we both know your story's bullshit. Patty didn't miss Mass. Patty didn't follow up on cases on his personal time. Patty stayed alive because Patty loved his family."
I stared dismally at my hands, folded neatly in my lap. I badly needed a manicure. I tried to imagine what the wife of an officer who died mere hours after visiting a pretty young woman and was given the inane reason for the visit I was offering would think and feel. She would know she was being lied to. And the unknown always takes on greater, more terrible proportions than whatever truth is concealed behind the lie. Would she believe, as her brother did, that her beloved Patty had cheated on her and betrayed their marriage vows the morning he died? I never used to lie. Mom raised us to believe that every lie puts something out there in the world that's inevitably going to come back and bite you in the petunia. I can't explain Inspector O'Duffy's actions. I can only tell you what he did. He came by to tell me Alina's case was staying closed. That's all I know. I drew comfort from the fact that if I came clean and told him everything, confessed every bit of it, down to my suspicion that O'Duffy had somehow learned that something big, nasty, and not human had moved into Dublin and been killed because of it, he'd believe me even less. The afternoon was endless. Who owns the bookstore? How did you say you met him? Why are you staying there? Is he your lover? If her case is closed, why haven't you gone home? How did you get those bruises on your face? Are you working somewhere? How are you supporting yourself? When do you plan to go home? Do you know anything about the three abandoned cars in the back alley behind Barron's Books and Baubles? The whole time I waited for Barron's to come and rescue me, the product, I suppose, of growing up in a world where nearly all the fairy tales I'd heard as a child had a prince rushing to the rescue of the princess. Men down south love to play up to that image. It's a strange new world out there, and the rules have changed. It's every princess for herself. It was 5:45 before they finally let me go. O'Duffy's brother-in-law escorted me to the door. "I'm going to be watching you, Miss Lane. Every time you turn around, it's my face you're going to see. I'm going to be taped to your ass." "Fine," I said tiredly. "Can I get a ride back to the bookstore?" "Okay, that was a no." "How about the phone? Can I use it?" He gave me another hard look. "Are you kidding me? You guys wouldn't let me get my purse this morning. I don't have money for a cab. What if somebody out there mugs me?" Inspector Jane was already walking away.
"You don't have a purse, Miss Lane. What would somebody mug you for?"
he tossed over his shoulder. I glanced uneasily at my watch. When they'd picked me up at the bookstore, they'd made me remove the flashlights from the waistband of my jeans and leave them with Fiona. Thunder rumbled, vibrating the glass panes in the windows. It was going to be dark soon.
"Hey! You there! Wait up!"
I didn't break stride.
"Beautiful girl! Wait a minute! I was hoping I'd see you again!"
It was the beautiful girl part that flung a noose around my foot, the voice that snagged it tight. I raked a hand through my recently butchered hair and looked down at my dark, baggy clothes. The compliment was balm to my soul, the voice young, male, and full of fun. I skidded to a halt. Shallow, I know. It was the dreamy-eyed guy I'd seen in the museum the day I'd been searching it for Oops. I turned bright red. That was the day Lane had amped up the death by sex thing and I'd stripped in the middle of Ireland's famous ore exhibit, right there in front of God and everybody. Flushing, I sprinted off again, splashing through puddles. It was raining, of frogging course, and the sidewalks of Dublin's crack-filled Temple Bar district were nearly empty. I had places to go, darkness to race, guys who'd watched me strip to avoid. He dropped into a long-legged lope beside me, and I couldn't help myself. I slanted a look at him. Tall, dark, dreamy-eyed, he was boy on the cusp of man, in that perfect stage where guys are velvet skin over supple, hard bodies without an ounce of fat. I'd bet he had a six-pack. He was a serious lefty. Once upon a time in my life, I'd have given my eye teeth for a date with him. I'd have dressed in pink and gold, swept my long blonde hair up in a playful ponytail, and painted my nails and toes to match young hearts beat free tonight blush.
"Fine, I'll run with you then," he said easily. "Where are you off to in such a hurry?"
"None of your business. Go away, pretty boy. You don't fit in my world anymore." How I wished he did.
"I was afraid I wouldn't see you again."
"You don't even know me. Besides, I'm sure you saw more than enough of me at the museum," I said bitterly.
"What do you mean?"
"You know." He shot me a quizzical look.
"All I know is I had to leave right after I saw you. I had to go to work."
He hadn't watched me strip? Some of the ugliness of my life melted away. "Where do you work?"
"Ancient languages department."
"Where?"
"Hunky and smart." "Trinity."
"Cool. Student?"
"Yeah. You?"
I shook my head.
"American?"
I nodded. "You?" He didn't sound Irish.
Little of this, little of that. Nothing special.
He smiled and winked. Dreamy eyes, long dark lashes. Wow. Right. This guy was special all the way down to his toes. I wanted to know him. I wanted to kiss him. I wanted to feather my lips on those lashes. And he'd probably end up dead if he hung around with me. I killed monsters other people couldn't see, and had just spent the entire day in the police station on suspicion of murder for the death of a man I hadn't killed instead of the 16 I had. Leave me alone. I can't be your friend, I said bluntly.
That's way too intriguing to pass up. What's your story, beautiful girl?
I don't have a story. I have a life. And you don't fit in it.
Boyfriend?
Dozens.
Truth?
Is.
Come on, don't diss me.
Consider yourself dissed. Fuck off, I said coolly. He held up both hands.
All right, I get it.
And stopped. I pounded down the sidewalk away from him and didn't look back. I wanted to cry.
I'll be around,
he called.
If you change your mind, you know where to find me.
Right. Ancient Languages Department at Trinity. I made a mental note never to go there. I think they know me, I said when I pushed through the front door of the bookstore. Barron's was behind the counter, not Fiona. That was weird. He was actually ringing up a purchase like a real person doing a job. He cut me a look of warning. Mute it, Ms. Lane, and jerked his head toward the customer.
Flip the sign,
he said when the patron left. He slapped a cardboard placard on the counter and began writing on it.
Who do you think knows you?
The shades. They get, I don't know, agitated when they see me coming. Like they recognize me and I piss them off. I think they're more sentient than you know.
I think you have an overactive imagination, Miss Lane. Did you turn the sign over yet?
I flipped over the sign. That was Barron's, autocratic down to his steel-booted toes. Why, wrapping up early? He finished writing, walked over, and handed me a placard to hang on the door next to the sign. I read it. For how long? I was surprised. The bookstore was our cover, and now he was closing it?
At least a few weeks. Unless you want to start running the cash register, Ms. Lane.
Where's Fiona?
Fiona turned off all the lights and left a window open last night.
I staggered, physically stumbled backward, and nearly fell from the impact of that mental blow. I caught myself on a display table, toppling a few baubles and stacks of the latest bestsellers. Fiona tried to kill me? I knew she didn't like me, but come on, talk about excessive.
She claimed she was only trying to frighten you off. She wanted you to go home. I was beginning to think she'd succeeded. Where were you all day?
I was too busy reeling from Fiona's viciousness to answer him. It was bad enough that I had to watch my back with all the known nasties. I wasn't well-versed enough in feminine wiles to see the subtler nasties coming. God, what did she do? I breathed. Sneak back in late last night? How did she get out herself?
Same way you did, I imagine. Flashlights. I must admit, Miss Lane, I'm impressed with how well you cleared the place. There must have been shades everywhere.
There were, and I didn't. I only cleared part of it. Vlaine did the rest, I said absently. How ironic that I'd been so doggedly trying to save her from the very monsters she'd turned loose on me. There was a moment of frozen silence, then Barron's exploded.
What? Vlaine was here, in my store?
His fingers banded around my upper arm.
Ow, Barron, you're hurting me, I snapped.
He released me instantly. Barron's is dangerously strong. I think he has to maintain constant awareness of what he's touching, or he'd end up breaking bones. I rubbed my arm. I would be bruised tomorrow. Again.
My apologies, Miss Lane. So?
No, of course he wasn't in the store. You have it warded, don't you? Speaking of which, why didn't your wards keep the shades out?
It's only warded against certain things.
Why don't you ward it against everything?
Wards demand resources. Protection has a price. All power does. Lights serve well enough to keep the shades out. Besides, they're stupid.
I'm not so sure about that. I told him about the one that had faced off with me in the back room, how I'd lost my flashlights and been left with only a pack of matches that I'd nearly run through, how Vlaine had appeared in the back alley and driven it off. He listened intently, asked me many questions about our conversation, wrapping up with,
"Did you fuck him?"
"Ah!" I yelled. "Of course not!" I rubbed my face with both hands and kept it buried there a minute. "Wouldn't I be an addict if I did?" I raised my face. Baron studied me, dark eyes cold.
"Not if he protected you."
"They can do that? Really?"
"Try not to sound so intrigued, Ms. Lane."
"I'm not," I said defensively.
"Good. You don't trust him, do you?"
"I don't trust anybody. Not him, not you, nobody."
"Then you might just stay alive. Where were you today?"
"Didn't Fiona tell you?" I was learning from his tricks. Answer a question with a question. Distract. Evade.
"She was hardly forthcoming when I fired her."
There was a hesitation before the word fired, nearly imperceptible unless you knew the man. "What if she comes back around and tries to hurt me again?"
"Not a worry. Where were you?"
I told him about the Garda, that I'd spent the day at the station, that O'Duffy was dead.
"And they think you slit the throat of a man nearly twice your size?"
He snorted.
"That's absurd."
A sudden, deep quietude blanketed my mind. I hadn't told Barons how O'Duffy had died. "Yeah, well," I blustered around it. "You know how cops are. By the way, where have you been lately? I could have used help a few times in the past 24 hours.
"You seem to have done well enough on your own. You had your new friend, Vlaine, to assist you."
He said the name in a way that made the prince sound like a prancy little fairy, not the virile, lethally seductive fae he was.
"What happened to my window out back?"
I wasn't about to admit to a man who already knew how O'Duffy had died that I knew he was keeping some kind of monster under his garage. I shrugged. "I don't know. What?"
"It's broken. Did you hear anything last night?"
"Had my hands a little full, Barons."
"Of shades, not Vlaine, one hopes."
"Ha."
"You weren't in my garage, were you?"
"No."
"You wouldn't lie to me, would you?"
"Of course not." "No more than you would lie to me," I didn't add, "honesty among thieves and all."
"Well then, good night, Miss Lane."
He inclined his head and whisked silently through the connecting doors into the rear of the building. I sighed and began collecting the various books and baubles I'd knocked from the display table. I couldn't wrap my brain around the thought that Fiona had sneaked in last night and turned off all the lights. Chase me away, my Petunia. That woman had wanted me dead. I couldn't imagine anyone knowing Barons well enough to develop such strong feelings for him. Still, I knew there was something between the two of them, if only the intimacy and deep possession of long association. From the rear of the building came a howl of outrage. A moment later, Barons exploded through the connecting doors, dragging a Persian rug behind him.
"What is this?"
he demanded. "A rug?" I batted my lashes, thinking what a stupid question.
"I know it's a rug. What are these?"
He thrust it beneath my nose, stabbing a finger at the dozen or so burn marks. I peered at them. Burns?
"Burns from dropped matches, Miss Lane. Matches one might have dropped while flirting with a pernicious fae, Miss Lane. Have you any idea the value of this rug?"
I didn't think his nostrils could flare any wider. His eyes were black flame. "Pernicious? Good grief, is English your second language, third?" Only someone who'd learned English from a dictionary would use such a word.
"Fifth,"
he snarled.
"Answer me."
"Not more than my life, Barons. Nothing is worth more than my life." He glared at me. I notched my chin higher and glared back. Barons and I have a unique way of communicating. We have these little nonverbal conversations where we say all those things we don't say with our mouths, with our eyes instead, and we understand each other perfectly. I didn't say, "You are such a stuffy asshole." And he didn't say, "If you ever burn one of my $250,000 rugs again, I'll take it out of your hide." And I didn't say, "Oh, honey, wouldn't you like to?" And he didn't say, "Grow up, Ms. Lane. I don't take little girls to my bed." And I didn't say, "I wouldn't go there if it was the only safe place from the Lord Master in all of Dublin."
"You might reconsider that one day."
His voice was low, fierce, on the verge of guttural. I gasped. What? Intrinsic to our wordless free-for-alls was a tacit agreement never to elevate these conversations to a verbal level. It was the only reason either of us was willing to participate. He gave me a cool smile.
"That nothing is worth more than your life, Ms. Lane. Some things are. Don't put too high a premium on it. You may live to regret it."
He turned and walked away, dragging the rug behind him. I went to bed. The next morning I woke up, dismantled my haphazard monster alarm, opened the door, and found a small TV with a built-in VCR DVD player sitting in the hallway. Manna from heaven! I had been thinking, since Fiona was gone, about swiping the one she kept behind the counter. Now I wouldn't have to. There was a tape next to it. I toted the TV into my room, plugged it into the wall, slipped in the tape, and turned it on. The program was already queued. I winced and turned it back off. I kicked a chair. Every time I think I'm getting smarter, I realize that I've just done something stupid. Dad says there are three kinds of people in the world: those who don't know and don't know they don't know, those who don't know and do know they don't know, and those who know and know how much they still don't know. Heavy stuff, I know. I think I finally graduated from the don't-knows that don't know to the don't-knows that do. Barron's had security cameras in the garage. He had just given me a tape of myself breaking into it. 5. I flipped the sign, boldly lettered in hot pink Sharpie. Barron's Books and Baubles Summer Hours, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., Monday through Friday, it said, and locked the front door, feeling good about myself. I had just completed my first day on the new job. Up until now, bartending had been my only marketable skill, but today I'd broadened my employment horizons and could now add store clerk to my resume. An opportunity had presented itself to make money, and I wasn't about to let it pass me by. Barron's had offered me the job last night. "Unless you want to start running the cash register, Ms. Lane," he had said. After only one day, I could see the job was far more complex than merely ringing up the occasional purchase. There was stocking to worry about, special ordering to be done, bookkeeping to stay on top of, and spending time with patrons, helping them find things they didn't know they wanted. The store carried some cool stuff, but there were things that definitely needed changing. Some of the magazines had to go. I wasn't about to waste my precious time chasing teenage boys away from the male interest racks. The female interest racks were seriously lacking. I planned to add more high-end fashion magazines along with some eye candy, and the store definitely needed a more festive selection of writing implements. The hot pink Sharpie was mine. BB&B offered only your basic pens, plus a few prissy-looking calligraphy sets, the kind that make it take forever to write a single letter. Barron's obviously didn't understand that shorthand, LMAO, IMHO, GFY, was the new longhand, and in a world where everything was high-speed and wireless, nobody wanted dial-up anymore. My reasons for accepting the job were twofold. I was eventually going to run out of money, sooner rather than later. And if the Garda pushed their investigation, I could cite my job as the reason for my continued stay in Dublin. I was training to learn to run my own bookstore back in the States, I would tell them. Fiona's recently extended hours were absurd. There was no way I was working an 11-hour day. Since I was in charge now, I'd made my first executive decision and chosen new hours of operation, opening late enough that I could either sleep in the mornings or use them to take care of personal business. As far as state-of-the-world business was concerned, I had decided it wasn't my problem. Vengeance for my sister, and only blood relative as far as I knew, but those were murky waters I wouldn't swim in any more than I'd call home right now, was my first and only priority. Well, that and staying alive. I'd had 27 customers today, not counting the boys I'd run off, and I'd made good use of my time in between to begin putting the pictures I'd found at the Lord Master's, the ones of Alina in and around Dublin, into the new diary I'd purloined from the collection of hand-tooled leather journals sold at BB&B. Alina. God, why? I wanted to shout at the ceiling. Why her? There were millions of creeps in dozens of countries across the world. Why hadn't he taken one of them? Now that I knew I was adopted, I resented God doubly. Other people had lots of relatives. I had only had one. Would I ever stop hurting? Would I ever stop missing her? Would I ever live another day without this gouged-out place in my soul that I was desperate to fill with something, anything? Unfortunately, it was an Alina-shaped hole, and nothing else would fit it. But maybe vengeance would soften the edges of it. Maybe killing the bastard who had killed her would make them less sharp, less jagged, and I could stop cutting myself on them. Pasting the pictures of Alina into my journal had made the grief of losing her feel fresh all over again. With everything that had been happening to me lately, I'd actually woken up a time or two in the morning without the instant crushing thought, "Alina's dead. How am I supposed to get through the day?" top on the list in my brain. I thought things like, "I robbed a mobster yesterday, and now he's going to kill me." Or, "Vampires are real. Who'd have thunk?" Or, "I'm afraid Barons was my sister's boyfriend." Things like that. A week ago I'd laid that last one to rest, much to my relief. Now that weirdness in my life was the norm, grief and rage had resurfaced with a vengeance on a level I couldn't deal with. Inside me was a Mac I'd never met before. I couldn't dress her up. I couldn't make her take a bath. She wouldn't mix in pleasant society. I couldn't corral a single one of her thoughts. My only hope was she wouldn't suddenly sprout a mouth. She was a bloodthirsty, primitive little savage, and she hated pink. I dug in my heels. No way, I'm not going in there. I draw the line at grave-robbing barons.
It's not your pen.
Huh? Whose is it? What pen? I thought we were talking about crumbling gravestones, hallowed ground, and theft that was a crime against the tenets of church and man. We'd finished our discussion about pens on the way over, along with my plans for ordering new, cooler ones. He'd listened to me prattle in what I suspect was bemused silence. I get the feeling few women chat barons up. "And I'm paying you how much for running my bookstore?" was all he'd finally asked. At the last minute, I'd tacked a little on to the sum I'd decided upon earlier. When he agreed, I almost whooped with joy, except he'd stopped the Viper at that moment, and I'd taken my first good look around. We were on the outskirts of the south side of Dublin, on a narrow lane, right next to a very dark, very old cemetery. The last time I'd been in the cemetery had been for Alina's funeral. I closed my hands around the cold iron bars of the main entrance and swept a brooding glance over the headstones.
"The pen is a metaphor, Miss Lane. Drawing lines isn't your prerogative. It's mine. You're the oop detector. I'm the oop director. You'll walk the cemetery. I'm particularly interested in the unmarked graves behind the church, but make a thorough search of the building and the grounds as well."
I sighed. "What exactly is it I'm looking for?"
"I don't know. Perhaps nothing. This church was built on the site of an ancient meeting circle once presided over by the Grand Mistress of the She-Seers herself."
"In other words," I muttered,
It's probably a wild goose chase.
Remember the cuff Vlaine offered you?
Is there anything you don't know?
Legend has it there are multiple cuffs, each with a different purpose. Legend also has it that in ancient times, she-seers collected every fey relic they could get their hands on, and if it proved indestructible, secreted it away where they believed mankind would never find it. Some say when Christianity came to Ireland, she-seers encouraged the building of churches in specific places, even funded them, perhaps to keep their secrets safely buried on consecrated ground. Laws governing the digging up and relocating of remains are rigidly enforced.
It sounded plausible to me. These she-seers, were they like a club or something back in the day?
As much as they could be. Times were very different then, Miss Lane. Communication between enclaves took weeks, sometimes months. But in times of threat, they gathered in pre-appointed places and performed ritual magic. This was one of them.
Where did all the she-seers go? You said there are more of us out there.
When the Fae withdrew from our realms, the world no longer had any use for she-seers. A once vaunted position became obsolete. Those accustomed to being highly valued lost their purpose overnight. In time, she-lore was forgotten. Over the centuries, talents went fallow. As for where the ones who remain are, the next time you're out, look around. Watch. When you see something from Fairy, look not at the Fae, but the crowd to see who else is watching it. Some know what they are. Some are on medication for psychological disorders. Some betray themselves to the first one they see and are killed by it. It's how I knew what you were. I saw you watching the shades.
Psychological disorders? I tried to imagine seeing the monsters I'd recently encountered as a child, having no explanation for them, and realizing no one else could see them. I would have told my mother. She'd have been horrified, taken me for counseling. And if I'd told the counselor the truth? Drugs. A lot of them. I could see it happening all too easily. How many she-seers were out there, too sedated to care what was going on in the world? So this grand mistress, she ran things? He nodded. Is there still one today?
One would expect the bloodline that directed the she-seers for millennia to have maintained the lore.
That was one evasive answer I wasn't willing to accept. What does that mean? Do you or don't you know if there is one, and if so, who is she? He shrugged.
If there is one, her identity is tightly guarded.
So, there's something you don't know. Amazing. He smiled faintly.
Do your thing, Miss Lane. You might be criminally young, but the night is not.
My thing entailed making like a brisk vacuum through the church, and when I'd finished with the Spartan stone chapel, sweeping over the graves, up and down burial lanes, in and around mausoleums, searching with an inner antenna I'd not known I possessed, to collect things a few weeks ago I wouldn't have believed existed. I saved the unmarked graves behind the church for last. I was armed to the teeth with flashlights, although I knew no shades were here. Where shades dwell, no night crickets chirp, not a blade of grass stirs, and tree limbs gleam bare and white as old bones. I expected my stroll through the cemetery at night to be unnerving. I didn't expect to find the hushed world of the human dead soothing, peaceful, but there was an undeniable synergy here. Natural death was part of life. Only unnatural death, like Alina's, opposed the order of things and demanded retribution, a balancing of the scales on a cosmic level. I read the inscriptions as I passed. The epitaphs not worn to dust by time were heartfelt and warm. There were a surprising number of octogenarians and even centenarians interred here. Around these parts, life had once been simple, good, and unusually long, especially for the men. Barons waited in the car. I could see him in profile, talking on his cell phone. Finding an object of power, or OOP for short, is a talent not all she-seers have.
From what Baron says, it's rare. Alina had the gift, too, which is why the Lord Master used her. Don't think I don't see the similarities between us, my sister and the Lord Master, Baron's and me. Difference is, I don't believe Baron's is out to destroy mankind. I don't think he particularly cares much for mankind, but I don't think he has any deep-seated desire to see us all wiped out. Another difference is he hasn't tried to seduce me, and I'm not in love with him. I have a clear head about what I'm doing and why. And if one day I learn Jericho Barons did kill O'Duffy for snooping into his life and is one of the bad guys, well, I'll cross that bridge if and when I come to it. Revenge is a dish best served cold. I never used to understand that saying, but I think I finally get it. I'm hot-headed and inexperienced right now. I need to know more about the Fae and what I am. I need to be cooler, smarter, tougher, stronger, and packing better arsenal before I go after revenge. I need more oops like the spear. I need Barons. He's an endless source of information and knows all the right places to look. Take this cemetery, for instance. I never would have known it existed or what it had once been. I don't know the first thing about my heritage and even less about Irish history. Criminally young, he charged, and I can't argue, but I can change. I stepped into the shadows beyond the church, swinging my flashlights left and right. This part of the graveyard was enclosed by a low, crumbling wall of stone and had been fending for itself for years. No gardener toiled here. The grass grew tall and dense, and not one flower broke the stark pallor of many small cairns neglected beneath the heavy boughs of oak and slender limbs of yew. A broken wrought-iron gate swung from a single hinge that creaked a rusty protest when I pushed it open and stepped in. So much for my talents. I was thigh-high in grass and tripping over the darn thing before I sensed it. In my defense, there wasn't much of it left. "What is it?" I asked Barons, horrified. When I'd stumbled over the monstrosity, I'd screamed loud enough to wake the dead. Barons had come at a run. It was a misshapen lump at our feet, motionless but for the occasional terrible shudder.
"I do believe it's what's left of a rhino boy,"
Barons said slowly. "What happened to it?"
"I believe, Miss Lane, that something has been gnawing at it."
"What in the world eats rhino boys? And why?" He glanced at me, and I was stunned to see that he looked stunned himself, which was an exorbitant display of emotion for Barons.
"It had to be another Fae."
He sounded appalled.
"Nothing human could take down one of these things, and would certainly have no cause to eat it. As for the why, I have no idea. It goes against everything that is she. Fae do not savage one another. Even the lowest of the Unseelie would consider this an atrocity, an abomination. Packs of them would turn on the defiler."
"Will it die?" I asked. There was so little of it left, yet it lived, and its agony was obvious.
"Not unless you stab it with your spear, Miss Lane."
"Will it eventually regenerate or something? It was missing major parts."
"No. Only the royal castes have that power. It will exist in this form forever, unless one of its own race stumbles across it and takes pity on it, which is unlikely. Or you do."
His gaze was heavy on me.
"Do you pity it?"
I stared into his dark eyes. Sometimes they seem bottomless, not entirely human, and this was one of those times.
"Tell me, Miss Lane, will you walk away from it? Let it suffer for eternity? Or are you an angel of mercy?"
I bit my lip.
"Which will it be? Knowing one of these things murdered your sister. Perhaps not a rhino boy, but certainly one of its brethren."
"The Lord Master killed my sister. I was sure of it."
"So you say. He's not Fae, and the marks on her body were."
There was that. Still, if he hadn't actually dealt the killing blow, he was the one who'd orchestrated it. I narrowed my eyes. Barron's was testing me. I had no idea what his twisted idea of a passing grade was. I only knew what I had to do. There is a synergy to life and death, and this did not fit. I slid the spear from my boot and stabbed the rhino boy. Barron's smiled, but I don't know if he was mocking me for being weak or lauding me for being compassionate. Screw him. It was my conscience I had to live with. As we were leaving the cemetery,